I want to pick up the story of the immune system where we were last time at the very end. And at the end of class last time, we talked about the idea of clonal selection. And we talked almost entirely about B cells, plasma cells, and how the humoral immune system. And what I want to do today is, we talked about the humoral immune system, and I want to compare that to the other branch of the immune system, which we overlooked last time, which is the cell-mediated. So we were talking about humoral. And there's also cell-mediated. So I want to explain what these are, and then we're going to talk about their commonalities, and then their differences. So in the humoral immune system, as we've already explained, the cells make a specific protein. They make antibodies. And every antibody, in a simplified picture, has one end which is specific for its target, usually a protein, and one end which is not. So this end is usually called V, and this one C for constant. And we'll explain more about what this means in a little while. Now, in the cell-mediated system, you have a similar kind of protein. But instead of being called an antibody, it's called a TCR. And what that stands for, we'll explain in a minute, but it's a similar protein with a variable part and a constant part. Now, the point of the immune system, from our point of view, is to make proteins that will destroy foreign proteins, but not so much foreign proteins as foreign microorganisms. And they'll do it by producing antibodies that attach to those bacteria or those viruses or their pieces, and which destroy them. They immobilize the bacteria and viruses, and then your amoeboid, your phagocytic cells, can come along and engulf the invaders and do them in. Now, there's really a lot of feedback, so let me turn down the mic a little bit. Now, that's what the humoral system does. The cells involved, which are called B cells usually, make antibody, and that antibody is found in the blood and the tears, that is, at other parts of the body, which are called humors, that is, floating around. So that's why that's called the humoral immune system. The cell-mediated part of your immune system involves not free antibody-like protein, but antibody-like protein on the surface of cells. So these cells are called T cells, and therefore the protein that sits on their surface is called the T cell receptor. Now, this doesn't mean it's the receptor for T cells. This means it is the receptor on T cells. So that if this is a B cell, releases an antibody into the humors. A T cell holds on to its specialized protein. So the T cell receptor is always on the surface of the T cell. So it's, if you consider the cell that made it, the special protein is always on the surface. Now, what about B cells? When a B cell first makes antibody, that antibody is on the surface. But when that cell is triggered to divide by clonal expansion, by meeting its antigen, then this cell specializes and it actually secretes free antibody. So there is a stage where the antibody is on the B cell, just as the TCR is on the T cell. But when the B cell gets into action, it secretes antibody. And its major function is as a secreted. Now, when the B cell looks like this back here, and it has its antibody still on the surface, some people call this form of the antibody the B cell receptor, or the BCR, in parallel to the T cell receptor. Because in each of these cases that we've drawn, the cell has a protein on its surface ready to grab foreign stuff. Now, the cell-mediated system is called the cell-mediated system because for this protein to find a partner and do anything to it, this whole cell has to move. Because the antibody-like protein is on the surface of the cell and the entire cell has an effect. It turns out that not only does the antibody-like protein, the TCR, have to be on the surface, but its target has to be on the surface. And it has to be on the surface of a eukaryotic cell. So the target is on the eukaryotic cell surface. Now, what about the humoral system? When you make an antibody and it's floating around in your blood, where is the target? The one place it isn't is on the surface of your own cells. It's your target is either floating around in the blood or it's on the surface of a bacterium or a virus. So the target can be soluble or on the surface of a prokaryote or a virus. It's not on the surface of a eukaryote. And one of the things that we're going to explain today is how your body distinguishes between eukaryotic proteins and bacterial proteins, because the difference is big. When this cell binds to eukaryotic cells, your cells, that have gone bad, they're either infected by viruses or they're cancerous and growing out of control, but they're making some protein they're not supposed to make. And so they are killed by the cell-mediated system. So what happens to the target? What this does is to kill infected cells. As opposed to the humoral system, which largely kills or leads to the destruction of bacteria and viruses. So one protects you against the bacterium and the virus particle. But if the virus gets into a cell and starts to replicate, the cell-mediated system will get rid of the infected cell. Now, we all know that there are autoimmune conditions or side effects of some of these things. Allergies are thought to be a side effect, most of them, are side effects of the humoral system. You make too much antibody, it reacts with innocuous things and causes trouble. Graft rejection is thought to be due to the cell-mediated immune system. We have not, in our evolutionary history, done tissue grafting. Nobody ever got an organ transplant in the old days. So there is no reason to think that we have evolved a system for rejecting grafts. We assume, though, that when you get eukaryotic cells from somebody else, they look like your infected cells, and they get zapped. That's thought to be the primary explanation. So we have these two halves, the humoral immune system and the cell-mediated immune system. And they both work in certain ways that are very similar. But before we discuss that, I think we have to take a closer look at what cells are involved here. If we've mentioned B cells and T cells, what are they? So if you have your handout from last time on the top, that's 23C, and if you want one, there are more here. That has a picture of the various kinds of cells that we're talking about. T cells and B cells both come from the same lineage. The same stem cells give rise to both, and they're both derived from the blood. Now, if you consider the blood in total, you can separate it into the cells and the liquid part, which is called the plasma. And just so you understand what these terms mean, you've also probably heard of serum. If you allow the plasma to clot, and you separate the clot from the liquid that remains, the liquid that remains is the serum. But now, back to the cells. So the cells are usually divided into red blood cells, or erythrocytes, and white blood cells, or leukocytes, the difference being hemoglobin. And we know what red blood cells do. They carry the oxygen, etc., around. But what we're talking about now is the white blood cells. They're responsible for the immune system. And they can be divided, again, into what are called phagocytes, which are amoeboid-like cells, and lymphocytes. T and B cells are both kinds of lymphocytes, as it says here. Now, phagocytes are very important in the immune system also. These are amoeboid-like cells. Macrophages form into this category. Another very important kind is dendritic cells. We're not going to talk about them, but they turn out to be big players in the immune system. And then macrophages you probably have heard of. These are amoeboid cells, and they crawl around. They're not just found in the blood. They're also found in your tissues. And these cells serve two important functions in the immune system, sort of at the beginning and the end, that they capture antigen. And they then are able to take that antigen and essentially present it to lymphocytes so that lymphocytes are triggered into action. And the lymphocytes actually are the effector cells that carry out the primary activities of the immune system. The B cells make antibody. The T cells mediate the cell-mediated immune system. But in order to rev these cells into action, you need the phagocytes. In addition, once a cell or a protein has been attacked by antibody or a TCR, then the remains have to be cleaned up. And the remains are cleaned up by these phagocytic cells, which engulf and digest them. Now, there's one more piece of this that we want to do, and that's the subdivision of T cells. T cells actually come in two halves, two kinds, which are called TC, well, make it match your handout, TH and TC. C stands for cytotoxic. These are so-called cytotoxic T cells, also called TCLs. No, CTLs. Cytotoxic lymphocytes. And these are the ones that carry out the destruction of infected cells. But there are also these things called helper T cells. Helper T cells have a completely different effect. Helper T cells are needed to kick into action both B cells and cytotoxic T cells. So unless you have helper cells, neither half here will work properly. Now, why are they called T and B cells? That has to do with where the cells mature. The same stem cells give rise to cells, some of which differentiate into T cells, some differentiate into B cells. But the B cells differentiate in the bone marrow, and the T cells differentiate in the thymus, and that's how they have their names. Now, the two kinds of T cells have totally different functions. How does the organism or whatever tell them apart? How do we tell them apart, which is which? Because we actually measure how many helper T cells you have, how many, etc. That's done by a surface protein. The surface proteins on lymphocytes are called CD1, CD2, CD3, blah, blah. So helper cells have the protein CD4 on their surface and are said to be CD4+. And cytotoxic T cells have the protein CD8 and are said to be CD8+. Now, you probably realize that HIV infects helper cells. One of the proteins of HIV sticks to CD4, so CD4 is said to be the HIV receptor. Now, the function of CD4 is not to bind HIV, but it happens to do that on the side, unfortunately. So when you're infected with HIV, it takes up resonance in your helper cells, and eventually, it usually destroys your helper cells. And if your helper cell count gets low enough, you can't kick your cytotoxic Ts into action, and you can't kick your Bs into action. And as a result, neither half of the immune system works. And you get AIDS, which is acquired immune deficiency syndrome. Now, what we want to do is we want to consider how do you activate these cells, how do you get them to do their thing. So we want to come back and look at this clonal selection business. Clonal selection applies both to B cells and to T cells. In both cases, you have a collection of cells with either antibody or T cell receptor on it. So before any foreign material comes along, notice no antigen there, antigen here. This picture, or something like it, is on the bottom of 23C. That before or pre-antigen, each B or T cell specializes and differentiates and makes a particular protein with a particular grabber or specificity section, a specific variable. Then, when antigen comes along, it binds to the appropriate trap or target or receptor. And the cell to which it binds either multiplies, that's clonal expansion, and makes more, or that cell is killed or suppressed. If that particular cell is suppressed, then you get what we've called tolerance. If that cell multiplies, it will make more cells. It will make two kinds of cells, effector cells and memory cells. The effector cells will either produce antibody if they're B cells and kill infected cells if they're cytotoxic T cells. And if they're helper cells, they'll help out the other guys. And these so-called effector cells, you may remember from last time, are short-lived, but they're very active. The memory cells, on the other hand, lie around waiting for next time. And they are usually more specialized than the original, more highly differentiated, and there are more of them. And that's why your immune response is larger and bigger the second time, because there are more cells, and they are more fully primed to react. So this same basic scheme works for both T cells and the production of T cell receptor, and for B cells and the production of antibody. What, however, is different about them? And we've already covered what our main differences are, that the T cell protein, the T cell receptor, remains on the surface, and its target must be on the surface. Now, this is perhaps clearer if you look at 24A at the top, where we have first B cells versus T cells, and then cytotoxic Ts versus helper Ts. So first, let's look at, say, B versus T. So here's a B cell with surface receptor, And here's a T cell with surface receptor. So each of these proteins, the TCR or the antibody, also known as BCR, each of these has their variable specific for antigen part and their not specific part. And each of them is on the surface to begin with. But when stimulated by antigen, where does that antigen have to be? The antigen for a B cell can just be all by itself. And in response to the stimulus, the cell will actually secrete antibody. So the antigen doesn't have to be on the surface of anything. And in the long run, the antibody, which goes around through your humors, doesn't have to be on the surface of anything. But that's not true for a T cell. In order for a T cell to react, the antigen has to be on the surface of another cell. And in fact, a eukaryotic cell, as we've explained. And then these two can get it together. But a T cell will not react with free antigen. Now, as we mentioned last time, these little triangles aren't really a whole antigen, but a piece of antigen to which an antibody or a TCR binds. And so the proper name for this is really an epitope or an antigenic determinant. This is a suitable small piece of antigen, and how you get little pieces we'll get to in a minute. So for the TCR, both the specific binding protein and the epitope or antigen have to be on cell surfaces. This is not true for B cells and their antibody. Now I realize there is one thing I left out, but I will come back to it. This explains one part of it. But what about cytotoxic T cells versus helper T cells? Cytotoxic T cells are supposed to only pair up with infected cells. Helper cells are supposed to only pair up with other members of the immune system and help them along. How does the T cell know the difference? So now you want to look at the next picture, which has cytotoxic Ts versus helper Ts. So again, we have the T cell, and the T cell has its TCR. It's actually, if it were for the same epitope, they would be the same. So this is the T cell receptor looking for a surface antigen or epitope. So the target cell has to have antigen. If there is no foreign substance on the surface of your cells, T cells won't stick to them. But why might you have foreign material? You might have foreign material because this is an immune cell and it captured a little bit of it. Or you might have foreign material because the cell is infected and making extra proteins. How does your immune system know the difference? Now, you may remember that there's another protein on the surface of these T cells. There's the CD4 protein and the CD8 protein. That's different between these two, and they have to match up with a protein on the surface of the other cell. So let's put that in. If you have a cytotoxic T, it's going to have CD8, and if you have a helper cell, it's going to have CD4. Now, CD8 and CD4 match up with a protein on the surface of the corresponding cell, which I've drawn here like this. This protein is called MHC, which stands for historical regions for major histocompatibility complex, which we don't care about. The point is that this is on the surface of eukaryotic cells, And it comes in, it's very variable, so that yours and mine are different. And the critical thing is there are two basic kinds. There are actually more, but there are two basic kinds, which are called MHC1, imaginatively, and MHC2. Now, it turns out that MHC1 is on the surface of all nucleated cells, all nucleated eukaryotic cells. So who wouldn't have it? Prokaryotes don't have it, but do any of your cells like it? Remember, your red blood cells have no nuclei, so they don't have it. But virtually all your other cells do. So both of these cells actually have MHC1. And in fact, if we want to, we could draw it on both of them. But the difference is that in the infected cell, MHC1 is associated with a foreign epitope. And in the case of your immune system, it isn't. So, let me just leave this out. MHC2, on the other hand, is only found on certain cells of the immune system. It is not found on T cells, but it is found on B cells and phagocytic cells. And these are called classic antigen-presenting cells because of this. Antigen-presenting. Now, what do we mean by presenting? If you just look at this picture, it looks like a regular cell has MHC1. And if it's infected or gone bad, it will have other foreign epitopes on it as well. And those two are recognized by the cytotoxic T cell. And the cytotoxic T cell requires both. If you just have MHC1, you're just an ordinary cell. If you have just plain antigen, you're a bacterium or a virus or something. But if you have both, you're a human cell gone bad, and we got to get rid of you. Similarly, the so-called antigen-presenting cells, many cells of the immune system, have MHC2. And they also have a foreign antigen. And it is this combination that is recognized by a helper T cell. If you just have MHC2, it means you're an immune system cell, but you haven't caught anything. If you just have antigen, you're something else. But if you have both foreign antigen, foreign pieces of protein, and MHC2, then you are a cell of the immune system that caught some antigen, and we should help you along to make antibody or to be a cytotoxic T cell, as the case may be. Now, you notice on the right hand of your picture, you have a slightly different cartoon. That's because the antigen or epitope and the MHC are not really separate. The epitope or antigenic determinant, or little piece of antigen here, this little triangle, is really inside MHC. MHC has a little groove. MHC 1 and 2 are a little bit different, but each of them has a groove. And the little piece of antigen fits in the groove. People say it's like a hot dog in a bun, because you have a short peptide inside the bun. Antigen, epitope, MHC. So that's why that picture on the right, to give you some sense of more of what it really looks like. That you have the bun with the hot dog. And the bun is either whole wheat, MHC1, or it's white bread, so to speak, MHC2. Okay. So the fact that CD8 goes with MHC1, CD4 goes with MHC2, and TCR goes with epitope allows these cells to pair up properly. because these proteins have to pair up, and therefore the cells pair up. A B and a T cell have to be activated to do their thing. If we come back to this clonal selection thing, you have the B or the T cell lying around, and it's already making an antigen or a TCR. But it doesn't do anything, an antibody, excuse me, or a TCR. It doesn't do anything until antigen comes along. But to kick it into action, you don't just need the antigen. You need other factors. And that whole process is called activation. How you get the quiescent T or B cell to multiply and make effector cells and memory cells. And that activation requires this kind of interaction. Now, what do we call this kind of interaction? Where a surface protein on one cell binds to a surface protein on another cell. This is called juxtacrine signaling. When we gave out a handout that had all the different kinds of signaling, like paracrine and endocrine, et cetera, this is on it, but I think I forgot to mention it at the time. Juxtacrine signaling is very big in the immune system and in development. That the surface protein on one cell contacts the surface protein on another cell, and you get signaling either in one direction or mutual in both. Now, in order for a T or a B cell to be activated, you actually need multiple signals. You notice there are two juxtacrine interactions here. There's the CD4 or 8 with the MHC part, and then there's the TCR with the proper antigen epitope. You also need paracrine signaling. That means one cell secretes something, and the other cell has a receptor for it on the surface. Now, paracrine signaling is very, very widespread. It's very important in growth control and many, many other things. Paracrine signaling is relatively ho-hum, and that's why we're not going to go into how it works here. But in addition to these juxtacrine interactions, one of these cells usually has to make a paracrine that stimulates the other, or you don't get anywhere. And there's a whole big collection of paracrines involved. And just so you should know, if you do any reading, the paracrines that are made by lymphocytes are called lymphokines. And for historical reasons, they're known as interleukin 1, 2, 3, 4, etc., up to about 30. So like IL-1, IL-2, etc. Now, your problem book does refer to these, because in some years we've talked about them. And it does explain what they are. But when you are given problems to do on exams, etc., you don't have to know which of these is which or what they do. But it's there for reference in case you're interested. So activation of a T or a B cell requires juxtacrine interactions and paracrine interactions. And what does it achieve? An activated cytotoxic T can kill an infected cell. An activated helper T cell can aid either a cytotoxic T or a B. And an activated B cell can secrete antibody. Now, maybe we should look just a little bit more closely at this activation business. How does a helper T, for example, get activated? The helper T has to interact with a so-called antigen-presenting cell. The antigen-presenting cell has got some antigen, cut it up into pieces, and the pieces are sitting on MHC. Which one? Antigen-presenting cells are B cells and phagocytes. Those are cells of the immune system, and they have MHC too. They also have MHC1, but it doesn't have any antigen. But their MHC2 has antigen. So they have, just write MHC2. And so that has to interact with the appropriate proteins on the surface of the helper cell, and that activates the helper cell. Now, how do you activate a B cell? This could be a B cell. And under some circumstances, a B cell can activate a helper, and a helper can activate a B. But it's thought that the more common way it works, most of the time, is an antigen-presenting cell of a phagocytic type activates a helper cell. And then that helper cell activates a B cell. Now, the B cell also has MHC2 plus antigen or epitope, and that has to match up with the right proteins on a helper cell. And the helper cell then activates the B cell, and the B cell grows and divides and secretes antibody and makes memory cells. Now, what about a cytotoxic T cell? The process for activating that is complicated, but the last step is if you have a cytotoxic T cell, what does it nestle up to do its thing? Has to be an infected cell, a eukaryotic cell. What is it that the T cell recognizes? I know you're infected. It recognizes, again, MHC plus antigen. It's just the other kind of MHC. So this is MHC1 plus antigen. Okay. Now, one of the reasons for writing this up is to show you that these two are parallel. That the T cell nestles up to a target cell that has MHC with a little antigen in it. What's different is whether it's MHC2 or MHC1. And what's also different is where did the antigen come from? How does an antigen-presenting cell get its antigen? The answer is it ate it. Either it was a B cell, or it was and it got it in by receptor-mediated endocytosis, or it was a phagocytic cell and it engulfed it. So let's write that out, because that turns out to be a big difference. The way you get a protein, or the way you get an epitope stuck onto MHC 1 or 2 is different. And that relates to all the stuff we've talked about earlier in this class. Phagocytic cells are moving throughout your body, patrolling things. And if they find something foreign, they engulf it by their amoeboid operation. So they engulf antibody. What about B cells? How would they get their hands on antigen? Did I say antibody? They engulf antigen. How does a B cell get its hands on antigen? If you come back to this picture, the way a B cell gets antigen is it has this antibody on the surface that traps antigen. So the picture would look like this. How does the antigen get inside? What does this look like? The old RME pictures. So with a B cell, once it traps antigen, it takes it inside by receptor-mediated endocytosis. And in both cases, the antigen ends up inside the cell it ends up actually in an endosome. And in the endosomal endomembrane system, the antigen is cut up into little pieces. The pieces meet MHC2. And by the usual exocytosis of vesicles, The MHC2 plus antigen goes to the surface. What about an infected cell? How does it get antigen epitopes on its surface attached to MHC? Well, the surprising thing is that cells take the proteins that they're making, and little bits of them are always getting turned over. They're getting worn out and degraded, and the pieces are reused. Now, when you digest most proteins inside a cell, what do you use? Use a proteasome. So what happens in a regular cell is whatever proteins it's making makes proteins, and a certain sample of all of those proteins goes to the proteasome and is broken down into peptides. And those little bits of peptide, some of it gets onto MHC1. Now that means that this peptide has to get back into the endomembrane system, which it does. And there it meets MHC1 and goes to the surface. So that means that all of your cells at any one moment have all but your red blood cells, have on their surface MHC1 with a little sample of pieces of whatever protein they happen to be making at the moment. So each of your cells has on the outside little bits of what it has on the inside. So that's how T cells can tell from the outside what's going on inside. So if these little bits on the outside are what is supposed to be there, little bits of ordinary normal protein, your cytotoxic T cells don't do anything. But if these little bits of protein are foreign, then the cytotoxic T cell will destroy this cell. So what happens in an infected cell? An infected cell makes, in addition to its regular protein, viral protein. Some of those proteins get into the proteasome. Some of those pieces get onto the surface of the cell, and the cytotoxic T cell zaps it. Now, this is basically what I wanted to say about the cellular part. And now I want to talk about the molecular part, which is how you account for the structure of antibodies. But let me stop first and ask for a question. Yeah.
In regards to the helper cell, how exactly does it help?
How does a helper cell help? Now, that's a very good question. Perhaps the best example is here. How helper cells help cytotoxic T cells is complicated, and I deliberately don't want to go into it. But how does a helper cell activate or trigger a B cell? Well, remember, to be activated, what do you need to get? You have to get a paracrine signal, and you have to get a juxtacrine signal. So the helper cell provides the paracrine, although we haven't written it. The helper cell secretes something that binds to a receptor. But also you have to have the juxtacrine signal. So that means that the CD4 and the T cell receptor on the helper cell have to stick to their targets on the B cell in order for the B cell to be activated. Yes?
How do B cells get activated for antigens that the body has never seen? How does it have antibodies to begin with?
How do you have antibodies to begin with to antigens you have never seen? Now, this is the part sort of that I left out. So let's look at that. Before you have ever met antigen, your body makes cells, each of which, either B cells or T cells, is making a different antibody or TCR. And you make a whole collection of these, and presumably one of them is going to turn out to be the right one when the antigen comes along. But how do you make so many different ones? How are you able to make zillions of different messages and proteins, each one of a different amino acid sequence? Now, the short answer is that unlike all the other cells in the body, the B cell and the T cell lineage, their differentiation involves the rearrangement of DNA. So that the DNA coding for antibody or the DNA coding for the TCR consists of little pieces that can be rearranged or scrambled or resorted. So that each of these cells has a different version of the gene coding for antibody. So each of them is making a different antibody and will continue to do so because of the state of that gene. And the next thing I want to talk about is sort of how you do all that. But let me ask if there are more questions before I go on. Yeah?
How would the immune system react to, say, a fungal infection? Because I know those are eukaryotes, but I assume they wouldn't have
infections. I'm not sure how the immune system handles fungal infections. It's a good question, but I don't know. And I would suspect from what happens that it doesn't do very well. Yeah?
Are all the receptors for a given B cell or a T cell identical?
Are all the... Yes. So if a particular cell... Well, if a particular cell is making antibody, all those antibodies have the same variable region. They don't necessarily have the same constant, as we will explain. If a T cell is making T-cell receptors, as far as I know, all of those are the same. So that means that a specific B-cell or T-cell can only cuddle up, really, to one or a very small number of closely related epitopes. Okay. So now I want to look at it from the angle of looking at antibody structure. TCR structure and antibody structure have many similarities, but we're going to stick to antibodies. Now, we usually draw an antibody the way I did over there. So let's do that again. We usually draw an antibody as having the variable or V and constant regions. Something like this. Now, and we say that different antibodies vary in their grabber part, something like that. Now, it's true that every antibody actually has two grabbers, and we'll come back to that. But this picture is to illustrate that the grabber part is different for each antibody in terms of specificity. Each of these three is capable of holding on to or attacking a different epitope or antigen. But it turns out that you have what are called classes of antibody, of which there are five major classes. And their details are on handout on the B side. We're not going to go through that little table on the top, but that little table on the top gives you the properties of the five classes. Now, what's different about one class versus another is the so-called constant or C region. So to illustrate that, you can have two different antibodies, such as I've just drawn. One in three have the same constant region, but a different variable. One and two have the same variable, but a different constant. Now, the constant region determines where that antibody is, whether it's in the fluids, in your body fluids, which ones, etc., and whether it can pass membranes, etc., etc. I mean, epithelia. That's in the table. So the biological consequences of binding antigen depend on the constant part. But which antigen you can get depends on the variable part. So the antigen specificity is in the variable, but the biological consequence of binding that antigen is in the constant. And there are five major types of constant region, which are called mu, delta, gamma, epsilon, alpha, and the corresponding antibody is called immunoglobulin G, for example, if it has a gamma chain, or immunoglobulin A if it has an alpha chain, etc. IgG is the major antibody found in your blood. But there are all these others as well. Okay. Now, in a way, the remarkable part of this is when when a B cell starts out, let's say at this early stage, depending on how the DNA was arranged, the variable part is essentially fixed. And it stays the same. And as the cell divides many times and produces effector and memory cells, they have essentially the same variable region. But the constant, so-called, changes. So at the early stages, cells have one kind of constant region. The antibody has one kind of constant region. And at the later stages, the descendant cells make an antibody that has the same variable region, but it has a different constant. So it binds to the same antigen, but the consequences are different. This is called class switching. So we're saying that the setup of the V part is largely before you meet any antigen. But which C it's attached to changes after you meet antigen. Now this means that after you meet antigen, the variable stays the same and the constant changes. Got that? So the question is, how does this work? Now, in order to understand how that works, you have to look at the actual molecular structure of antibodies. And that's written, that's in the middle of your handout. That's on the B side. So on the very far right, we've redrawn our usual picture to show that every antibody has two grabbers. Not one. And I've drawn the two parts like this to illustrate that the antibody really has two halves which are the same. And it can be split in half. And the two grabbers are the same. Now these halves are actually connected by disulfide bonds, but the two units are clearly distinct. Some antibody classes have multiples of this basic unit, but this is the basic unit. But in terms of peptide chains, this basic unit is made of four peptide chains. So each half has one big chain and one small chain. But since you have two halves in an antibody, that means every molecule of antibody has two shorter chains that are called L for light chains, and two heavier, bigger chains that are called H for heavy. And the two H chains and the two L chains in a single antibody are the same. Now, there's some lab tricks that can produce otherwise, but we think in normal circumstances, they're always the same. And we drew it over here with this sort of bend because the way the molecule actually looks in three dimensions, it's sort of bent in the middle, and this is called the hinge region, which corresponds to about here. Okay. So, what constitutes the grabber or the variable part or what combines with antigen? It turns out that these two ends, and this is written in the usual way, where these are the amino ends and the carboxyl ends, that the left half of the light chain and the corresponding part of the heavy chain make up one grabber, or variable region. And here is another. So that's the variable part. And the rest is the so-called constant part. So light chains have a constant part, and heavy chains have a constant part. And when you have class switching, that involves only the heavy chains. which class of antibody we're talking about, whether it's IgG or IgA or IgF, there is no IgF, IgD, which it is, depends on the heavy chain. So that determines class. And when there is switching, when a cell goes from making IgM to making a different class of antibody, it changes the constant part of the heavy chain. The light chain stays the same. So, by the way, how do we know all of this? Normally, you have a collection of B cells, many different ones making many different antibodies. So to get a lot of a single antibody type is extremely difficult. But there are cancers derived from antibody-producing cells, and those cells produce only one type of antibody. They are an expanded clone of one of those cells over there. And all of those cells are making the same antibody, and those cells have been used to figure out the structure of antibodies. Now, let's look as a cell develops, as clonal expansion occurs, and cells meet antigen, and they become more specialized, what happens to the kind of antibody they make? So let's look at that, and then we'll go back and see how they do it, starting with the DNA. So you want to go back to the handout to the A side, to the bottom. And what we're following here is the B cell lineage as one B cell becomes more and more specialized. So a single B cell precursor differentiates, and it starts making antibody of class M. That means it has a mu heavy chain. Then as that cell specializes, and all of this is no antigen, before antigen, the cell, and this is for reasons unknown, makes antibody of the M type and D, but with the same variable region. So which variable section you're going to make has been fixed. But this cell then is making what is the equivalent of 1 and 2. Same variable, but different constant. And then those cells sit around waiting for antigen. And most cells never meet their antigen all of their lives, and they die off. But if this cell meets the appropriate antigen, what will happen? This cell will multiply. And some of its descendants will be effector cells and secrete antibody, and some of them will become memory cells and lie around for next time. Now, what will the effector cells do? The effector cells will secrete type M. So they'll switch from making surface M to secreted M. Do we know how to do that? That's alternate splicing, alternate processing, same DNA, different processing of transcript. You make a protein that doesn't have a hydrophobic tail and it gets secreted. But some of the others, the cells that are going to become memory cells, do otherwise. They actually switch to making surface G or surface E or surface A. And there may be some cells left making surface M. So this is before antigen and post-antigen. That's what that dotted line is. So the cells that secrete M are short-lived effector cells. But the cells that switch to making surface G, E, or A are memory cells. And they wait around till next time. They are more specialized, and I only wrote one of each, but there would be more of them. So when antigen comes along the second time, it's going to bind to, say, this cell, and it will make IgG. Or if it binds to this cell, it will make IgE. or this one, IgA. The second time, you will get a different class of antibody primarily, and you will get more of it, and it will happen faster. So we talk about the primary response to antibody, to antigen, involves the production of mostly IgM. So that's called primary antibody. And the second time, you make mostly G, E, and A, and those are called secondary antibodies. Now, the question that remains is, how do the cells pull it off? We know one part of it. We know how a cell can switch from making a surface version to a secreted version. But how does a cell switch from making no antibody to making a particular antibody? And then how does it switch from making the M or D version to the G, E, or A version? And that's what I want to talk about now. And that requires that we look at the genes that code for the antibodies, and that's on the bottom of B. It turns out you don't really have a gene for antibody in the first place. Instead, you have DNA coding for pieces of antibody. And it's how you put those pieces of DNA together and how you do transcription that determines what you get. So in everybody's genome, there are two copies of the H gene, or the H region of the DNA, the part of the DNA that codes for the heavy chain. Now, since you're diploid, you have two of them, but we've only drawn one. And then you have two genes capable of coding for light chains that are called kappa and lambda. Lambda and kappa. And you have, again, two of each of those, but I've only drawn one. So you're going to use one of your two H's by rearranging the DNA. You're going to be able to code for one heavy chain. What happens is you rearrange the DNA here, and if it works, you quit. If it doesn't work, you rearrange the other copy of the DNA of the H region. If that works, fine. If that doesn't work, the cell dies. In addition to rearranging the H region to make yourself a functioning H gene and a functioning H chain, you have to make a functioning L gene and a functioning L chain. Now you get four chances to do that, because you have two kappa genes and two lambdas. So you try and rearrange one of these. I forget which it is first. If that works, great. Not to try the other one. If that doesn't work, you try one of the other two. You get four chances. So some of your cells make decent antibody, and the rest of them die off. Now, what have you got to start with in the raw materials? If you look at the H region, you have what people call V, D, and J. And then they have C's. The part marked C is what codes for the constant part of the heavy chain. Either you use this part, and you get an M heavy chain, or you use the delta part, and you get a D heavy chain, or you use the gamma part, and you get a G heavy chain, etc., etc. The part over here on the left codes for the variable. All of this together codes for the so-called V region. Now, what you have here is a bunch of sections which are capable of coding for the subdivision of V called V. So when we look over here, and we set that this section here, this is called V, VEE. And one part of it is coded for so-called V by V, V, one by D, and one by J. This is historical. People thought there were a bunch of Vs and you picked one. Then they realized there were a bunch of Vs and Js. And you picked a V and a C, and then the J was the joining one. So you picked a V, a J, and a C. And then, oy vey, they discovered there were Ds. So what happens is the DNA is rearranged to to put one of the V sections next to one of the D sections next to one of the J sections. So you have one contiguous V, D, J. Anything that used to be in here is lost. Anything that used to be in here is lost. This means that immune cells, cells of the T and the B lineage, have special enzymes which allow them to cut and rejoin DNA selectively. And you do that, so there's one V, one D, one J, and then the Cs. And that happens before meeting antigen back here. Actually, here. So then what happens, and something very similar happens with the light chain. Now, how does that get you an M-type antibody? Which type you have depends on the heavy chain. So how am I going to get an M-heavy chain or a mu-heavy chain out of this? Notice that M is the first one in line. Mu is the first one in line. So if I transcribe sort of this part, and then I use that message, I can make M-type heavy chain. Probably it stops here. I can make M-type heavy chain. Now, how am I going to make D-type heavy chain? Notice the D is only a little bit further on. And it turns out that by alternate splicing of this processing and splicing of the same transcript, I can make either the M version or the D version. And that's why if you come back to this picture and you look at it more closely, you'll notice that these arrows are different depending on whether the process is alternate splicing or rearranging of the DNA. That this step is rearranging of the DNA, but the second step is alternate splicing. What's this one? This is alternate splicing. To go from making a surface version of M to a secreted M is alternate splicing. It turns out to go from surface A to secreted A is alternate splicing. But to go from the M to D is alternate splicing. But to go further, I have to rearrange the DNA. Now, how can you make so many different V regions or so many different antibodies or TCR that are specific for so many antigens? You have a lot of Vs, a lot of Ds, and a lot of Js. The approximate number is written in your handout. So you pick one from column A, one from column B, one from column C. So the number of combinations that generate a VDJ just by pick one of each is very large. This is part of what people call the generator of diversity, or G-O-D. The generator of diversity here is partially the mix and match-em of Vs, Ds, and Js. But there's more to it. Remember that when you make an antibody, it has both heavy chains and light chains. So we've said that there are many possibilities for the heavy chain because you pick one V, one D, one J. There are also many combinations for the light chain because you can use either kappa or lambda, and then there are several Vs and several Js. So one way you get variation is by picking number different VDs and Js. Another way you get diversity is by mixing and matching H and L chains. But that isn't quite all of it. It turns out that when you make the joint, when the enzymes catalyze the cutting of the DNA and the joining of V to a D, they don't always do it the same. They don't do it exactly. So you can add or delete a few bases. So that adds one level. Inexact joining adds another level. So between the fact that you can mix and match the VDJs on the heavy chain, and you can mix and match the V and Js on the light chain, and you can mix, and that is an inexact joining, and you can mix H chains with light chains, it turns out the number of antibodies you can make is enormous. It's not infinite, but it's enormous. And that's why you can usually make an antibody to just about anything. Because you already have a B cell which is capable of making antibody to bind to just about anything that can come along. Now, there are things that some people can't make antibodies to, and those they are never will never be immune to and cannot fight. But most of you can make antibody to just about anything. Now, this explains something of the process that occurs here, which explains specificity. Why you can make such a large collection of antibodies with different combining sites. But what explains class switching? How do you get from making M on the surface to making G? It turns out that you go from making M to D by alternate splicing. By the way, nobody knows what D is for. You don't have much secreted D in your blood ever. But we do know that cells need the D in order to respond to antigen. You can't activate it until it makes the D. But why? Nobody knows. So once you have now antibody and it meets the cell ready primed and it meets antigen, how does it switch from having M on the surface to G on the surface? And that requires another round of rearranging the DNA. You notice if you come back here that these are arranged in order. And if I take out these two, the next one will be G, or gamma. So now, if I take out those two middle ones, and I transcribe the DNA, I'll transcribe the VDJ part, same as before, but now I'll transcribe the part of the constant that makes a G. So the way you switch to making G is to get rid of the part for making M and D. How do you make the next one? If you look at your handout, you see they go gamma, epsilon, alpha. And cells make G and sometimes switch to making E. And when they make E, they sometimes switch to making A. But they never go back. And that's because to switch to the next guy, you have to delete the DNA. And once you have deleted this DNA, you can never make a G heavy chain again. But you can still make E or alpha, and so on. Now, this, believe it or not, is only the beginning. The immune system is incredibly complicated, and that's one of the reasons we've talked about it last. Another reason we talked about it last is because it uses many of the other processes that we talked about earlier. Now, there are some other things in your notes for reference and for your own interest. The fact that MHC, TCRs, and antibodies all have a common structure, a similar structure, and a common origin, and how we think it happened. All of this antibody stuff, unfortunately, has enormous practical significance. And that's because we are possibly facing a pandemic of swine flu. And one of the interesting questions is why flu? Of all the diseases that humans are subject to, why does flu come in waves and our immune system doesn't save us? And the basic answer is that flu is one of the most variable of viruses. And because it is so variable, it means that the antibody you made last time is not sufficient to wallop it this time. Your memory is for the wrong version of the virus. And flu is unfortunately very contagious. And the combination of being variable and contagious means that we have waves of flu infection. Now, the good part is that most of these waves are not that serious. You lose a few days' work, you feel awful, and you get better. But there are a few variants of the flu that are much more serious and that cause much more serious responses. And this is what they're worried about. This is a flu that produces an immune response that's so bad that the immune response is what does you in. And so it is healthy people with a good immune response who get sick. So hopefully that is not what we are facing. And the problem in Mexico is because Mexico City is the most polluted place in the world. And that's why the cases there are so much worse. Hopefully, we're facing a pandemic of mild flu, and so many of you will get ill, but all of you will recover. So thank you all, and I hope to see you Tuesday, but if not, it's okay.